Welcome to The Confident Mind, the weekly podcast of overcomingsocialanxiety.com. I'm Kyle McDonald, your host, and I'm a psychotherapist. Each week, I'll be bringing you news, information, and interviews all about the mental skills of mindfulness, along with news related to social anxiety and mental health. I'll be talking about how to be more mindful in your everyday life, examining the research and science behind mindfulness, and giving you the occasional short practical mindfulness exercise. And to check out how my comprehensive online treatment program can help you with social anxiety, shyness, and being more confident, go to overcomingsocialanxiety.com. So joining me on The Confident Mind today is Dr. Aaron Jardine, who is a senior lecturer at the Auckland University of Technology. He's also president of the New Zealand Association of Positive Psychology and lead investigator for the International Wellbeing Study and co-investigator of the Sovereign New Zealand Wellbeing Index. And today, Aaron, I'd like to talk about wellbeing. Welcome to the podcast.
Oh, welcome. Thanks for having me.
So tell me, what is wellbeing research?
Well, that's the big question, really. At this stage of the game, if you take a construct such as wellbeing and get people to define it, essentially they disagree a lot about what the term essentially means. So, and that's kind of led into various problems from an academic perspective. So we have all these different theories and models of wellbeing, but no agreement either within disciplines, so like within psychology, or even across disciplines when you talk to economists of wellbeing or happiness or philosophers or sociologists or policy people. They all have a different kind of idea of what this thing wellbeing could mean. So that's kind of led into different models and theories of wellbeing, which have essentially different ingredients or recipes for wellbeing, depending on what they conceive of wellbeing to be. But just to give you a bit of a flavor, one of the most common and popular theories of wellbeing is by the founder of a field I do some work in, which is called positive psychology. So a guy named Martin Seligman has a theory of wellbeing which has an acronym PERMA, P-E-R-M-A. Which stands for, he thinks, if you're to have high well-being, you have high positive emotions, you're engaged in life, you have lots of positive relationships, you have a real good sense of meaning, and you're out there accomplishing things. So PERMA stands for P for positive emotions, E for engagement, R for positive relationships, M for meaning, and A for accomplishment. But that's just one of many competing theories and models, right. But that just gives you a bit of a flavor of his recipe of what well-being is.
So it's not quite the same thing as happiness then, is it? Because, for instance, meaning might be things that are quite difficult but are ultimately very meaningful.
Yeah, exactly. So under that particular model, you'd put happiness in the positive emotions or the P at the start. And you'd certainly say having a range of positive emotions, so just not happiness, but other ones like joy and awe and so forth, are very important to having a sense of a life well lived and having high well-being. But being happy and not being sad, which is the sort of opposite of it, is kind of one small part of your overall well-being. So it's a marker. It's definitely important. It's hard to have high well-being if you're not happy. So it's an important marker. But the kind of scientists that are getting into this new field are sort of scientifically trying to figure out just how important that is at the moment, because it's also quite possible to be to have a lot of mixed emotions at the same time. So while it's kind of it would seem common sense to think you can't actually be happy and sad at the same time, that's not what the data is showing us. It actually shows us that in fact they overlap a little bit. You can actually be happy and sad at the same time.
Interesting. So how I mean, the International Wellbeing Study sounds very impressive. How do you go about measuring a population's wellbeing? How do you even start with something like that?
Well, that's a very good question. And I must sort of qualify it by saying I don't think we really know, and I don't think we've done a very good job. And it is a very initial state of this, what's called a National Accounts of Wellbeing Science. So the attempts to measure wellbeing or happiness or flourishing or whatever you want to call it, but essentially what's going right with life at a national level is turning out to be very, very challenging. And that's mostly because probably for the main reasons would be, one, we don't have good definitions of well-being, so that always influences what you measure to start with. The second would be it's turning out to have a huge cultural component. So when we do take standard measures around the world, we find that some cultures, what makes up their well-being is very, very different to another culture. So, for example, some of the Latin countries, their well-being is really driven by their social connections. So flipping back to Martin Seligman's model of PERMA, the R was positive relationships. It would say that what builds a person's well-being in a real kind of Latin country has a lot to do with their positive relationships and less to do with, say, the A in that model, how much they're accomplishing. Same in other societies like Japan. And here in New Zealand, although I don't have any data to back it up, I postulate the same thing between Maori and Pākehā. I would say a Maori person's well-being is built a lot more, or is more contingent upon the quality of their social relationships than a Pākehā person. A Pākehā person's probably a lot more to do with their sense of accomplishment, for example. So that's just a bit of a flavour of how these things differ cross-culturally, but we really haven't worked that out a lot yet, because we really don't know what well-being means to people in different cultures.
Right. So the traditional sort of Western European well-being leans quite heavily on the accomplishment aspect, does it?
According to that model, but there are totally different models. I guess I'm just sort of saying we still really just don't know. And these are huge generalizations too. And yeah, you're definitely right, new science. So this all sort of kicked off with the Kingdom of Bhutan having an interest in what they called gross national happiness a few years back. And they sort of wrote it into their constitution. The king became very interested in it. So they made it more focus of their way of life. And that sort of flowed into some of the Western countries finding out what they were doing. And then some of the European countries took a real lead on this, in particular France, and then the UK, David Cameron got involved and they started measuring it at a national level and putting a lot of money behind it. And more recently, Australia's really got into it and realised how important it is. But other countries, not so much. It really differs across the Western world. But yeah, in New Zealand, at least, we're moving in that direction, but we're not leading this at all.
One of the sort of the cliches that I've heard, and I think it's probably from more the happiness research than the well-being research, is this idea that, you know, some of the surprises in some of those big studies was that, for instance, very poor people in Calcutta showed very high levels of happiness. Are you familiar with those results, or is that sort of a bit of an urban myth?
No, I'm very familiar with those results. In fact, the guy who published that study, Robert Wiswistein, is a good colleague of mine. He's coming out to New Zealand again shortly. But yeah, him and his father Ed Diener did those studies, and they show exactly that you don't need. This was to do with income and well-being. You don't need a lot of money to make yourself happy. And in fact, once you cover your basic needs in regards to shelter and clothing and food, there's a very sharp diminishing returns. It's what's called a curvilinear relationship. So, and we find that in the New Zealand data in the Sovereign Wellbeing Index too. There's very little difference between people that earn over $200,000 a year versus people that earn the minimum wage.
Yeah, and that's understandable because, I mean, the difference between the minimum wage and $100,000 a year is huge, but in terms of lifestyle and in terms of what you can actually improve in your life. But I guess that does slow down as you get more and more money, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it's what it sort of shows is once you've got enough to cover your means, if you want to improve your well-being, you're better off investing your time and effort in creating better positive relationships, thinking about the meaning and purpose of life, finding a job that you love rocking up to and engaged in, getting some hobbies and things that, you know, make you happy. All these things will count much, much more for your well-being than actually earning a little bit more. But the caveat there that we found within the Sovereign Wellbeing Index was a new finding that hasn't been published before, which was it really relates to the extent to which you're living within your means also. So the people that were earning $200,000 a year, if they were spending all of it, they were very unhappy and quite stressed. The people that were earning very little, if they were living within their means, they were very happy. So it's not actually the amount that you earn, it's kind of what you do with it and how that relates to your safety nets and things like that.
Right, and I'm not sure what, if anything, the research would say about this, but I guess what that makes me think about is the idea that so often in life what we struggle with in the Western and sort of consumer-driven societies is the comparisons that we make, that we tend to compare up and look at those who have more and in a sense create a dissatisfaction in ourselves.
Yeah, and we don't just do it on an individual level either. It's a consumer cultural norm. We do it in our workplaces. Like, for example, if you're in a big organization and you do an engagement survey, the first thing they do is peg it to a similar organization down the road, so to speak. And, you know, I go into organizations and try and convince them that it's not a very useful thing to do. You know, you should be looking at you and where you're at and how you can change and monitor that. And but you're right, these kind of comparisons either way really aren't that fruitful because they don't really tell you anything about what you can do to increase your well-being. And the second point there really is with spending money to improve your well-being, or this kind of consumer idea of if I just get a bigger car or a newer car or more stuff, so to speak. As humans, we adapt to things really, really quickly and really, really easily. There's very little that we don't actually adapt to. It's only a few kind of specific examples, things like the death of your spouse or becoming unemployed, where usually adapt to most things about 3 months, give or take, but those things like becoming unemployed or death of a spouse, they sort of last for sort of around four years on average, or going through a restructure in an organization. You know, most HR managers think it's going to take a few weeks, but that's the, you know, the data shows, again, it takes about 4 years for employees to bounce back. So the good news is we're actually really resilient as humans. We do adapt to most things, good or bad, and that's the case with spending money on a new car. You'll like it for a few weeks, but you'll just adapt to it after a while. So unless you're in a position to keep spending, you're going to reach the end of that road where, you know, you can have all the stuff in the world, but you know, you won't be happy. And that's why we see, if you look at the negative statistics, rates of suicide, depression, anxiety, all the negative indicators, you know, they're pretty even across socio-demographic groups for exactly that reason as well.
So it's interesting, isn't it? Because essentially what you're saying is something that I think people know instinctively, which is that the novelty wears off most things.
Yeah. Although there's always a caveat with these findings. It does sort of show that, you know, if you spend your money that has something to do with activities and other people, then you'll get basically a 3-to-1 return on your investment than if you're buying stuff. So, and that's related to these models of well-being, so positive relationships. So if you spend, you know, $100 taking your wife out to dinner and the movies or something, you're going to get 3 times more enjoyment out of that than if you spend $100 on the new gadget.
That makes sense, doesn't it? Forget the new car and go on holiday with your friends.
Yeah, because it's tapping into that part of this model of well-being, relationships, which we know is important for driving well-being. And whereas if you're just buying a car, it's not really tapping into, you know, how engaged you'll be at work or what sense of meaning you have in life or how much you're accomplishing or anything to do with your relationships. It'll make you happy for a short period of time, and that's about it.
Yeah. And how, I mean, I'm interested in that PERMA model. How does that model define and how do you measure in these studies the value of meaning? Because it seems to me that would be a very tricky thing and a very individual thing to be able to measure.
Oh, it is. It's incredibly difficult. If anyone listening is really interested in this, the guy that leads this, and particularly in measuring meaning and meaning in life, meaning at work, is a guy named Michael Steger. So he has a scale called the Meaning in Life Scale, and there's another one that's specific for a work context. But you're right. So if you Google him, you'll find out all sorts about this. But the way I look at it is there's 3 constructs which overlap a lot in this space. There's a sense of meaning, and then there's a sense of purpose. And the guy that sort of leads this is a guy named Todd Cashton. And then from my perspective, I think about values, personal values. And the three of us, Todd, Mike, and I, always have these debates about which one really underpins them all or comes first. Is it you have a sense of meaning in life from which you develop a purpose, and then your values or what's important to you come from that? Or is it, as I think, you develop a sense of values in life from which a purpose comes out of and things meaningful come out? So from a science-y, geeky perspective, we don't have any data to prove one way or another, but they're 3 constructs which overlap a lot. They're very similar, but actually when you define them, they're a little bit different. But they're all very hard to engage with for people because they don't think about what's meaningful in life or what their purpose in life is or their personal values very often at all.
I think for a lot of people, it's almost an accident sometimes. And I guess if you haven't had to think about it that much, it probably means you're doing okay on it, because I think a lot of times people, if they don't hit major bumps in the road, they just sort of end up following those things naturally. But I think, and it also seems, from my perspective, at least as a therapist, that often one of the big problems is people have gotten majorly sidetracked from those things that are important or haven't been able to connect with them in the first place.
Yeah, exactly. So there's this new developing field called post-traumatic growth. I don't know if you've heard of it or not.
No.
Okay, so it's called post-traumatic growth, and it essentially asks the question, what is it about some people that thrive through trauma versus the other people that don't? They crumble and perish. So how do you differentiate the people that do really well after a car accident or a rape, whatever the trauma is, versus the ones that don't? And it's kind of starting to clearly show now that they do 3 things in particular that are different to the ones that crumble. The first thing is They tap into their social connections more so than the people that crumble. So they use their networks. The second thing is they take stock and think about a sense of meaning and purpose in life. So exactly what you're saying, that they wouldn't have done for quite a while. So they reestablish what's purposeful, and that helps SEPs direct their goals on where they want to go after the trauma. And the third is they realize they've got actually quite a strong sense of self-efficacy. They can manage and deal with it. So initially they think it's, you know, that's the end of life, it's all going to go to custard. But actually over time they sort of realize they've got strengths and they can handle it and all that sort of thing. But that second one, that they start thinking about what's meaningful in life for them and where they're going in line with their values, that's really a key marker in what helps people thrive through trauma versus the ones that don't.
It makes sense, right, that if we can find meaning in it, then actually we can find ways to utilize the lessons and the things that come out of those kinds of events.
Yeah, well, you'd be familiar with Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning.
Yep, no, probably. That's been on a few recommended reading lists over the years.
Yeah, well, it was a good book.
Yeah, it was. Hey, Aaron, I know you've got to run, so thanks very much for joining me today on the podcast. I think there's a lot for us to talk about here, so I'd love to get you back on the show again sometime soon and talk more about some of these ideas. But some great helpful tips there for people when it comes to trying to think about how to improve our well-being. So thanks again.
That's it for this week. If you liked what you heard, please take a moment to review the podcast in iTunes. And to check out how my comprehensive online treatment program can help you with overcoming social anxiety, shyness, and being more confident, go to overcomingsocialanxiety.com. But for now, be mindful. I'm Kyle McDonald, and I'll see you next week for the next episode of The Confident Mind, the weekly podcast of overcomingsocialanxiety.com.